As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good.
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it is Saturday. Of course, it is Vault time. This episode originally aired on July 30th, 2020, and it was called Volcanoes of Life.
That's right. This is a fun one because we get into, you know, we have episodes where we get into the destructive power of volcanoes, and certainly that is a very real aspect of volcanic activity. But this episode is about the positive effects of volcanic activity for a number of different organisms. So it's a fun topic. Kind of turns your expectations on their heads.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be talking about something that I've been thinking about doing an episode on for a while, ever since I read an article a while back that really interested me. And that is the surprising and kind of counterintuitive link that has been proposed by many geologists now between life as we know it on Earth and the fires of Mount Doom, specifically the most violent and scary of geologic processes like volcanic eruptions and the movement of tectonic plates.
Yeah, this is a great topic to get into. We kind of had a preamble to this just a couple episodes ago when we were talking about eggs, and we talked about the volcano birds and the idea of a volcano being seeming, you know, almost paradoxically to be something that can nourish life as opposed to something that's just a purely destructive force.
Oh, I didn't think about that comparison at all. But yeah, the way that the volcanic sand babysits the egg for the megapode so that it can just run off and do its own thing.
Yeah.
Raised by a volcano. But so I thought a great place to start here might be with a brief reading from the Völuspá. It is a famous Old Norse epic poem from the collection that is known as the Poetic Edda. Now, this is an anonymous work. The author is unknown. But the Völuspá tells the story of the Norse gods culminating in their destruction in the fiery doom of Ragnarok. And I'm just going to read a couple of quatrains here. In anger smites the warder of the earth. Forth from their homes must all men flee. 9 paces fares the son of Fjorgan, and, slain by the serpent, fearless he sinks. The sun turns black. Earth sinks in the sea. The hot stars down from heaven are whirled. Fierce grows the steam and the life-feeding flame, till fire leaps high about heaven itself.
Nice.
And one fun thing about this poem, it's a bit of Tolkien trivia. Robert, tell me if you've heard this before, but the name of the wizard Gandalf that first appeared in Tolkien's The Hobbit, and then, of course, is like the best character in Lord of the Rings, the name of Gandalf comes from the Voluspa. Tolkien actually borrowed the name from a section known as the Tally of the Dwarves from this epic poem. Originally, he was going to apply it to the character in The Hobbit who became Thorin Oakenshield, the leader of the dwarf party, but then he decided later on that it made more sense to apply the name of Gandalf to the wizard, I think because Gandalf means something like magic staff elf, and I think he made the right choice. Like Gandalf, that makes more sense for the wizard than for Thorin.
I think so.
But a cool thing that happens in this poem, sort of part of the Ragnarok myth, is that there is a rebirth that follows this fiery doom. You know, after the fire leaps high to heaven and the kingdom of the gods is destroyed, Earth is not just left in cinders. Instead, there is a renewal from the fire. And the author writes, "Now do I see the earth anew, rise all green from the waves again. The cataracts fall and the eagle flies, and fish he catches beneath the cliffs." So there's this great link between fiery cataclysm and rebirth and renewal of life in Norse mythology. And of course, there, you know, these are symbolic elements. I'm not suggesting that they had some kind of scientific insight with this. It's just something, you know, that I think is taken as a metaphor largely about human life itself. But coincidentally, it ends up kind of ringing true with things we're finding out about geology and nature.
Well, it's something you see in a lot of different mythological cycles, right? I mean, you see it in Hindu mythology. You see it in various American mythologies, you know, thinking about Meso and South America in particular. It's this idea that things will rise, things will fall, that there will be cataclysm, that whole worlds will be destroyed, but new worlds will rise out of them and have risen out of them before.
Yeah, I was thinking about themes of fiery eruption and the greening of the earth together, or sort of a creator-destroyer duality. One that came to my mind that that I thought you might know something about, because I know I've heard you talk about Hawaiian mythology before, was the Pele myth.
Yeah. The Hawaiian goddess Pele is an interesting example, a deity of fire and volcanism. I was reading a book titled Pele, Volcano Goddess of Hawaii by H.R. Lo Nimmo. And he points out that when Polynesian voyagers first arrived in Hawaii, they would have brought their gods with them. Now we don't know where in the Hawaiian Islands this would have specifically been, which of the islands they would have landed on and where. And even when remains a topic of debate. I've seen dates ranging from 300 CE to 1000 CE. And of course, contact with Europeans didn't occur until 1778. But the newcomers would have arrived on sailing technology in keeping with that of the larger Polynesian expansion, as well as related cultural inventions such as gods and goddesses, all of which would then evolve into distinctly Hawaiian models afterwards. Mm-hmm. Now, as we've discussed in the show before, the Polynesians were some of the last true explorers of the inhuman regions of the earth. And their saga, which is full of fascinating history, is not unlike what we might expect of a spacefaring civilization, with time and space sufficient enough to see the splintering and continued evolution of societies from region to region as they spread out across these far-flung habitable spaces. Now, Nemo points out that the first Hawaiians brought with them Kane, Kanaloa, Ku, Lono, gods known throughout the South Pacific. But they also brought with them what was apparently a minor fire deity named Pele. And they didn't bring any volcano deities with them, but she was this fire deity that seemed to pre-exist. And she likely remained insignificant for a while there at first, just another minor deity like she was previously. But then eventually, the Hawaiian Islands shook, and the volcanic mountains, of which 6 are active today, belched forth fire, magma, and ash. And this is what Nemo writes. quote, this minor deity was apparently transferred to the volcanoes and became the goddess Pele, who was destined to hold a powerful position in the Hawaiian pantheon. The great volcanoes became her home, their power, her strength, their beauty and destruction, her manifestation, and their unpredictability, her temperament.
Now, Pele would not be the only god or goddess from a pantheon in the world that's associated with specific volcanic activity. But I would imagine that that a volcano god takes on a very special significance when you are an island culture. So when you're like geographically bound very close amidst a vast ocean to that ground forming and life giving volcano.
Yeah, I something to think about here is that we see other gods, particularly gods in the Greek and Roman cycle, that are associated with fire and also associated with volcanoes, but also associated with the forge, the forging of things. We also see this in Lord of the Rings with Sauron, is essentially a Hephaestus-type character, right? But as we discussed previously on the show in one of our armor episodes, you certainly don't see metalwork occurring on the Hawaiian Islands. I mean, you don't see iron there for the taking and the manipulation. They were using wood and fiber and shark tooth based technology and using so excellently. But I wonder how much of it too has to do with the fact that Pele would have been removed from that. There would have been no human forge to overshadow the natural cycles of fire in the earth. You know, and on top of that, here is the volcano itself. Here are the volcanoes in these volcanic islands where its activity, its geologic life is so obvious.
Yeah.
Now, Nemo spends much of this book discussing the ways that Pele is viewed and certainly drives home that she's not a monolith. Traditions and ideas regarding Pele range from religious belief and cultural identity to the abstract, the environmental, and even there are these numerous examples of supernatural sightings in which one claims to have seen or believes to have seen a beautiful woman standing in the fire. But there certainly is this recurring theme of one who creates with volcanic fire and may also take back via the same power of a, quote, traditional spiritual respect for the life forms her creation supports. For instance, in the book, Nemo does bring up a specific example, talking with someone who'd lost some property due to a volcanic eruption. And they ask him, well, how does this change the way you think about Pele? And they say, well, it doesn't. Pele gave this to me. She created the land and I was just using it. And now she has taken it back.
Yeah. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
Yeah. Now, the Lord that people are usually talking about when they say that is the God of Judeo-Christian tradition, right? Which brings up this question. Joe, you're more of an Old Testament kind of guy than I am. But have you ever run across this argument that Yahweh in Hebraic tradition may have started off as a volcano god?
Yeah, I was reading a bit about this. This seems like one of those things that it's kind of an interesting idea. You can't totally rule it out, but it seems highly speculative and based on kind of scanty evidence. So I would say it's one of those things that is possible, but probably not. I think it's mainly based on ideas about geography, like the idea that, that Mount Sinai would have had some kind of volcanic element in the past, and then referring to specific passages in the Bible which describe the Lord in terms that people say, well, maybe this could be describing a volcanic eruption or something. And it's one of those things that you can often do with these geomythology. Actually, I guess, would be technically geomythology, a geomythology inference. And so I'd say for this one, it's not impossible, but it's kind of a reach.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't think I'd run across it myself, but I saw mention of it, and one of the sources that was often cited here was a book by Jack Miles titled "God: A Biography," which is a popular work that seems to discuss this. So I looked it up, and it's in reference to Exodus 40:33-38. He writes, "Quote: Nothing in nature looks like a cloud by day and a fire by night, except a volcano. The depth of the Lord God's compelling but contradictory power is well evoked by the extraordinary image of a volcano brought into a tent." Now, speaking of volcanoes and gods, and getting back to Tolkien, now I've expressed in the show before that I love a good journal paper that digs into some Tolkien, that tries to find the science of Middle Earth. We've talked about that previously with the Hobbit. How many meals does a Hobbit need a day, and would they be able to march across the Earth? Also, we got into the metallurgy of the One Ring. So I was like, well, somebody has to have considered Mount Doom and the geology of Middle Earth. And sure enough, I found a paper titled "The Geology of Middle Earth" by William Anthony Swinthin Sargent, published in the journal Mythlore in 1996. Now, I know Mythlore doesn't have a resounding ring of geologic authority to it, but I looked up Sargent, who lived 1935 through 2002, and he was a professor of geology at the University of Saskatchewan, and he also apparently wrote a series of fantasy novels himself, The Perilous Quest for Lioness. I looked it up. I've not read it, but I've noticed you can get at least the first two books in the trilogy on Kindle and paperback.
So amazing. Okay, so he's the perfect person to write this, a fantasy novelist and clear geek who is also a professor of geology.
Yeah. And he wasn't the first, though. When he dives into this, he ends up citing an earlier paper by Robert C. Reynolds titled The Geomorphology of Middle Earth, which is published in The Swansea Geographer in 1974. Mm-hmm. So basically what Reynolds had done is he had applied the concept of plate tectonics to the entire geography of Middle Earth, recognizing four different plates: the Eriador plate in the west, the Rovanian plate in the north, and the Harad and Mordor plates in the south. And Sargent then used this as his starting point, kind of his bedrock, but updated it to reflect changes in plate tectonic theory between 1974 and 1996.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting, because I would say at the time The Hobbit was written, plate tectonics was not yet an accepted scientific theory.
Yeah. It's easy to overlook that, especially for those of us who've grown up in the wake of that and have, you know, just encountered it in our science books at a very early age.
Yeah, it's one of those things that just feels like people must have known this for hundreds of years. But yeah, the widespread acceptance of plate tectonics is fairly recent.
Here's a quote from that paper by Sargent. Quote, "Mount Doom is indeed one of four isolated volcanoes, each representing a hot spot at some distance from a plate margin, and all of them associated with evil doing. Dol Guldar in Mirkwood, Orthonk in Isengard, and Erebor, the Lonely Mountain." So he contended that Isengard was a volcanic crater with central Orthanc itself carved via technology and magic from a column of solidified lava thrust up from the vent in its last eruption. The Lonely Mountain, which is ever shrouded in gray and silent clouds, is another, and he argues that Smaug's chamber is just a reshaped lava tube. But Mount Doom, he underlines, is the only volcano that seems to be truly active in the time of Bilbo and Frodo. And the only recorded seismic events in the books occur first when Gandalf casts down the Balrog, and then when Gollum falls into the fires of Mount Doom with the One Ring. So ultimately, he says, for a world in which all the major events are revolving around activities at a single active volcano, Middle Earth is rather seismically calm while still being, quote, geologically like our own world.
Well, I got to say, I do not know what natural processes could create that perfect rectangle of mountains around Mordor. That seems implausible to me. I always looked at that map and said, that doesn't look like real Earth. You got to make the outline a little more jagged. I understand surrounded by mountains, but come on, look at those corners.
This is one of the things I really liked about R. Scott Baker's work, where his fantasy work takes place in this world of the three seas that is very much Middle Earth. That's been, you know, transformed via these various philosophical ideas and a lot of, the Crusades interjected in there and some other influences. But there is a Mordor-like location in the books with a central fortress and then mountains surrounding it. But in his books, this is essentially an impact crater created by this thing from space or beyond that has come to the Earth. And that is the central fortress in the middle of this this vast crater, and so the mountains encircling it are those that were cast up by that impact.
A plus, very plausible. I like it.
So anyway, there's some just additional Tolkien to just really kick things off here, but. Again, I would say that Sauron certainly is more connected to those gods such as Hephaestus, Adranus, and Vulcanus. They are all smiths in the human sense, all creators through technology rather than through the nature that seems to be their key metaphor here, the volcano.
Well, to bring it back into the real world and look at this duality of, the same entity that might be both responsible for the creating and sustaining of life, but then also fiery destruction and explosive calamity. I want to start by asking a question that we talk about on the show a good bit. And that question is, when you're looking at other planets, you stare out of the night sky and you're trying to find examples of other planets that might be able to sustain life, what are the conditions you would check for? I think the most obvious is liquid water, right?
Absolutely. I mean, water is the thing that, that more than just about anything else, we just can't remove from the equation and get to life as we know it.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we talked about when we discussed Brian Greene's book, The Until the End of Time. He has this great section where he connects the chemical properties of water to its role in the evolution of life. You know, the great power of water as this polar molecule and as a solvent, as a sort of three-dimensional canvas for the drafting of the structure of cells, allowing for energy to be processed and harnessed for replication. And of course, all of these virtues depend on water being in its liquid state. Water in its frozen or vapor state is not really useful for the evolution of life. But in addition to just looking for the direct presence of liquid water, there are other conditions you might be able to look for that could, at least in theory, make a planet more hospitable to the origin, evolution, and maintenance of life, at least in theory, and you might not expect it, but volcanic eruptions and the plate tectonics that volcanic eruptions might signal are another one of those conditions. So maybe we should take a break and then talk about that when we get back.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed, and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, we're back. So the idea we're discussing here is the idea that just as Pele is not merely a destroyer, but is also a creator, volcanoes and the underlying plate tectonics that they represent might also be key to life.
Yeah, and so I want to talk about an article that I was reading by a researcher named Craig O'Neill. So O'Neill is a director of the Macquarie Planetary Research Center, and he's an associate professor of geodynamics at Macquarie University. And he's done some direct research on simulating the evolution of heating models and heat thermodynamics within planets or geodynamics. And so he starts off by talking about how there are two things that make Earth unique in the solar system. You might think, because of the conversation we were just having a minute ago, that one of them is liquid water, but actually no, there are other objects in the solar system that have liquid water. Sometimes people bring up the example of Mars. I think that's still an open question. Of course, Mars doesn't have lakes or rivers. There's some indication that it may have transient liquid water here and there on occasion, such as in these features called recurring slope lineae, though I think I was reading a report that there is spectral analysis that has disputed the interpretation of these sort of dark spots that appear on slopes as actual water. I guess we don't know for sure what they are. But there are other examples that are more straightforward. Like, it is totally scientific consensus at this point that Jupiter's moon Europa has liquid water under its icy surface. It's got the shell of ice on the outside. Underneath that, it's got some oceans. They're sloshing around. They're having a good time. Who knows what's happening there? But there is also possibly subsurface water on Ganymede and on Enceladus. So the two features that O'Neill singles out that actually make Earth unique within the solar system are that Earth has plate tectonics and that Earth has life. And the question that he's raising is whether these two unique features are actually causally related, if it's not a coincidence that Earth's crust breaks apart into plates that shift around and move over its surface, that float on top of the mantle, that sort of spread apart in some places and then subduct and move down and get sucked back into the mantle in other places. Does that process contribute to the creation and sustaining of life?
Yeah, this is an interesting idea because it basically comes down to the question of whether a geologically active planet is necessary for life. Like, if there's something in this this continued geologic life that makes biological life more possible.
Right. And I guess there are ways that a planet could be geologically active but not have plate tectonics. Like, I'm going to get to this in more detail in a bit. But there are models of planets where there are not plates on the surface, where the surface is basically just one single spherical hard crust sitting on top of the mantle. But it can still have volcanic eruptions that could in some ways regulate the heating of the planet and control its atmosphere in a way that that could sustain life, according to some researchers. But we'll get in more detail about that in a minute. So
We know that one of the prerequisites for the evolution and survival of life as we know it is liquid water. But why is it that Earth has maintained the conditions necessary for liquid water basically the entire time it's existed? Ever since we've had liquid water, there has been the ability for water to stay liquid. It's been long enough to allow life to continue evolving the entire time Earth has existed. So how is it possible that Earth has been able to maintain these habitable conditions in an almost adaptive and almost kind of accommodating kind of way, right? Like, especially since the external conditions have changed, like the sun has grown 30% brighter over the same period of time. So the heat inputs on Earth have gotten much greater, and yet still the atmospheric climate of Earth has stayed relatively stable. And O'Neill offers the answer that what's going on here to keep Earth relatively stable is its the profile of its geological activity, primarily its plate tectonics. So first of all, you've got the idea that when you have plate tectonics, you tend to create volcanoes at the edges of tectonic plates. And when volcanoes erupt, they release stuff from the Earth. Stuff from the mantle comes up and is released up into the atmosphere. Probably the most important things that get released here are carbon dioxide and water vapor.
Now, this is a great point that we sometimes lose track of, perhaps, when we think about volcanic eruptions and their more destructive aspects. The idea that that you could have, and you do have examples of terrific volcanic eruptions blocking out the sun, essentially forming a kind of a nuclear winter type effect, sometimes on the scale of an entire planet.
Right. I mean, so that could be the case if particles get ejected up into the atmosphere that that shield the Earth from the sun's rays, and that can create a cooling effect. But over the long term, what they're releasing is greenhouse gases, which even though there may be particles that block out sunlight and cool the Earth at a shorter term, on a longer term, the volcanoes are polluting the atmosphere with CO2 and with water vapor that trap heat down in the atmosphere. So that works to help keep the atmosphere warm, but then there are processes of plate tectonics that work in the opposite direction too. The natural process of plate tectonics, it not only releases these materials into the atmosphere, it also cycles them deep back into the belly of the Earth. Now, the question would be, well, why is that important? Well, obviously, if you just keep pouring more and more greenhouse gases like CO2 into the atmosphere, the Earth could end up like Venus. You know, it could end up with so much trapped heat that the surface boils and there's no liquid water and thus no life. So how does Earth deal with the extra carbon dioxide that gets released from volcanoes? Well, as the tectonic plates of Earth slide around on the surface, there are sites where those plates get sucked back under the crust and into the mantle. The Mariana Trench is one example of a location where the plates are gobbled up by the Earth. And as these plates get sucked in, they take substances with them. They take water, they take carbonate or carbonic acid, which is the mineral form of carbon dioxide. So the process is essentially taking CO2 back out of the atmosphere and sucking it down deep into the Earth.
By the way, speaking of Venus, should drive home that Venus is apparently lacking in plate tectonics.
Oh, yes.
But for a long time, scientists didn't think there would be any kind of volcanic activity. But according to a Reuters report that came out just this month, scientists have identified 37 volcanic structures on Venus that appear to be recently active.
Well, I didn't know that, but that is an interesting indicator, and we can talk about more examples throughout the solar system as we go on, that it is totally possible to have volcanoes without having plate tectonics. Though if you look at a map of volcanoes on Earth's surface, some volcanoes just appear at random. You know, they might be in the middle of a plate, just some mantle hotspot somewhere. But most of the Earth's volcanoes, they line up right along those lines at the boundaries of plates. So, for example, the western coast of the Americas, the whole Ring of Fire, you know, around the edge of the Pacific Ocean plate is where a ton of the Earth's volcanoes are. But there's another interesting feature of plate tectonics that helps remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And that is mountains. I'd never thought about this before, but I read about this in a couple of articles in O'Neill's and another one I'm going to mention in just a minute. So the process goes like this. As plates move around on the surface of the Earth, they're floating over the mantle, they smash into each other, and they bunch up where they get smashed. So as they smash into each other over the millennia, they raise up the bedrock at their impact points, and one plate pushes the other up, and as the rock is raised up, it forms mountain peaks of exposed mineral bedrock. And O'Neill points out that mountains are one of Earth's major CO2 sinks. It's a place where CO2 from the atmosphere can be removed and stored in a stable form. Of course, another example that we could think about would be trees and plants. Remember that the flesh of a plant is made out of carbon compounds that are built out of CO2 that gets sucked out of the atmosphere and fused into carbohydrates using the energy from the sun. This is what photosynthesis is. So as plants build their bodies, they suck CO2 out of the sky, but mountains also suck CO2 out of the sky, but in a different way. They suck it out through weathering. So as rain pours down on the mountains, the CO2 dissolved in the rainwater mixes with the minerals that are exposed in the rocks of mountains. This forms new minerals, and then eventually those new minerals with the CO2 locked inside drain down the sides of the mountains and end up in the oceans. So every time you see a mountain range, you think that is like, it's like a toilet for carbon dioxide. It's just like the sky's toilet is what that mountain is.
Well, I don't know if that's the most romantic way to think of the mountains, but
I think it's beautiful.
Toilet of the, okay. But still the point is valid. Yes.
And then there are other sinks as well. Also, CO2 gets dissolved directly into the ocean water itself. So it's coming into the ocean in multiple ways. It gets absorbed directly from the atmosphere into the ocean, and it drains from the weathering of mountains and rocks down to the oceans and ends up in the ocean floor, often in the form of limestone. But in both of these forms, the carbon dioxide that's locked up in the ocean eventually can get subducted, right? Because at these places where the plates meet, it gets sucked back down into the mantle. Now, this takes a really long time. The processes we're talking about take place over geologic time, not like on human civilizational lines. So if you're getting your hopes up about the idea that, oh, you know, Earth has a natural thermostat, we don't have to worry about climate change, unfortunately, that's not how this works. The natural thermostat that's established by plate tectonics has helped keep the Earth within a temperature range where it can maintain an atmosphere and liquid water and at least some life forms. But this temperature range that it maintains is, number one, it's huge compared to the range that will support stable human civilization as it currently exists. Like human civilizations and cities and agriculture and the ecosystems we depend on are all much more fragile than the baseline of just maintaining an atmosphere, liquid water, and some life. And then, of course, the other point is that this process takes a really long time. So even if it could help maintain in a much narrower range that we depend on, it takes, you know, beyond human civilization levels of time to really reach equilibrium. But to sum up the process of how the thermostat actually works, I'm going to quote directly from O'Neill. He says, quote, "If the Earth gets too hot, high levels of rainfall and erosion start bringing CO2 levels down. If the Earth gets too cold and freezes over, the erosion mechanism stops, right? So it stops raining on the mountains and draining into the ocean. But volcanism, due to plate tectonics, continues pumping CO2 into the atmosphere and the levels build up, eventually melting the ice caps. It was this mechanism that allowed Earth to recover from a global ice age in the Neoproterozoic about 600 million years ago."
Yeah, so again, we're talking about processes that that are taking place at geologic scale and not a human lifetime scale. But then also on top of that, even if you were exceptionally long lived, you were essentially immortal, these are not pleasant changes to go through, I would imagine. Like in either direction, we're dealing with catastrophe here.
Oh, yeah. And these changes, again, what we're talking about is how the Earth's plate tectonic thermostat, if this theory is correct, which it seems like it probably is, how the plate tectonic thermostat is able to maintain Earth as a habitable planet. So like it's still going to have liquid water. It's still going to have an atmosphere. That's a very low baseline. You know, that during this time, there are going to be mass extinctions. There, you know, sea levels are going to be hugely rising and falling. Huge parts of continents get covered in ice and then the ice retreats. So this is not like stuff that would be like, oh, it's cold outside today. These are world changing variations. They just don't change to the point that Earth is no longer habitable like Venus or Mars. Does that make sense?
Yes. Still, out of catastrophe comes life. And speaking of that, we're going to take a quick ad break, but we'll be right back.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Jean, and Vlastar runs the business. I understand now. It is a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Jean, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh,
yeah. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
All right, so we've been talking about theories in geology about how volcanoes and plate tectonics might be important for making the Earth habitable for life and maintaining its ability to host life over time. One of the things we were just talking about was the idea of plate tectonics as a natural thermostat regulator for temperature on Earth, that allows the Earth to release and absorb greenhouse gases in a cyclical way that basically keeps the Earth from turning into Venus or Mars or some other uninhabitable hell. Now, there was another article I was reading that was in Quanta by the science writer Rebecca Boyle from June 7th, 2018, that mentioned a number of other theories that have connected plate tectonics and volcanoes to various life-related processes on Earth. And I found this all really interesting. So I just wanted to explore a few of the things that she gets into in this article. One of them is the idea that plate tectonics might possibly have been important for the origin of life itself. Now, this one's somewhat controversial because we don't know for sure when plate tectonics began on Earth. We don't know how early it got started. There are various theories about that. But for example, Craig O'Neill, the author of the article I was just talking about before the break, has been involved on research that posits that before the Earth had plate tectonics, it had a period of what is called a stagnant lid state, where it didn't have plates sliding around. It had this sort of single hard shell floating on top of the mantle. But Boyle's article points to research about how the subduction of plates on ocean floors actually creates conditions that are friendly to various types of extreme deep ocean life that we think of as being similar to or possibly the direct analogs of the earliest life on Earth. To quote one section, Boyle writes, quote, "As the Pacific plate is dragged down into Earth's mantle, it warms up and releases water trapped within the rock. In a process called serpentinization, the water bubbles out of the plate and transforms the physical properties of the upper mantle. This transformation allows methane and other compounds to percolate out of the mantle through hot springs on the otherwise frigid cold floor." And it's this type of chemical reaction that on the ocean floor could possibly have given rise to the earliest chemical metabolism and jump-started a chemical evolution of what would become cells and life as we know it. We don't know for sure, but it seems like one of the plausible origin theories for life on Earth.
In other words, the sort of ancient chemistry labs that are firing off random concoctions that then end up benefiting the emergence of life.
Right. Now, there's another thing Boyle's article mentions that touches on an issue we've discussed on the show before, which is the Cambrian explosion. Apparently, plate tectonics have also been implicated as a possible cause of the Cambrian explosion. Now, a brief refresher on what's going on here. Remember, we've talked about this fascinating paleontological mystery before. Roughly 540 million years ago, there is a dramatic change in the fossil record. Before roughly 540 million years ago, in a period that we know as the Ediacaran, most of the life we have evidence of is very simple. It's soft-bodied, worm-like creatures, sort of leaf-shaped, multicellular fronds, a lot of soft-bodied organisms, many of which are not preserved very well. And there is not there doesn't seem to be a lot of diversity of body forms taking shape rapidly. But then, over a period of time that is geologically really sudden, there's this proliferation of animals with lots of different body types that have hard body parts that are preserved very well in fossils, so we have good records of them. This is when you get the trilobites, Anomalocaris, Hallucigenia, Opabinia, all of your favorite monsters of the ocean primeval. This is the Cambrian explosion. And the question is, what explains this apparently sudden acceleration of evolution and diversification of life that happened about 540 million years ago? Now, there are a lot of competing theories. I think some paleontologists say, well, maybe the rapidity of the Cambrian explosion is sort of overstated. Maybe there's some bias in the fossil record. But I think it's generally agreed that, yeah, a lot of new animal forms really do show up pretty fast. And so other theories have to do with like changes in the composition of the atmosphere. One that we've talked about on the show that was pretty interesting is that it was a reaction to the evolution of hunting and active predation as a novel thing on planet Earth. There had not been hunting before. And suddenly, as soon as organisms are hunting each other, there's just like this rapid race to find new ways that bodies can be. But Boyle's article points to research from 2015 that actually links the Cambrian explosion to plate tectonic activity. So this is a paper by Ross Large et al., published in Gondwana Research in 2015. And what's their theory? Well, simplified, it goes sort of like this. Plate tectonics smash continental plates together. So the plates are moving around and they smash together. And at the places where they smash together, it often raises up mountain ranges. And these mountain ranges at the borders of plates consist of exposed mineral bedrock that's heaved up into the sky. We talked about this a bit earlier.
Oh, yeah. Now, we went into this a bit, too, in the gold episode where we talked about looking for gold in the ocean. And we talked just very briefly about why one pans for gold in mountain streams.
Yes, yes. A very good point. Yeah. So the rock that gets lifted up as it smashes together at the edges of these plates, the mountain that get raised up can be hammered by the elements. It exposes the underlying minerals to, you know, the wind, but primarily the rain. And the rain drains chemical nutrients from the rocks down into the oceans. And this causes a proliferation of chemicals like phosphorus, copper, zinc, selenium, cobalt, and stuff like that in the seas. These nutrients in the ocean then allow high biological productivity, the proliferation of life, intense competition, and speciation.
So it's kind of like some of the most important chemicals of life have been hidden by the gods in the deep earth. And mountains, they're the Prometheus figure freeing those and releasing them into the ocean where they can become a part of life.
Exactly, yes. And so Boyle writes, quote, maybe more surprisingly, Large and his colleagues also found that these elements were low in abundance during more recent periods, and that these periods coincided with mass extinctions. These nutrient-poor periods happened when phosphorus and trace elements were being consumed by the Earth faster than they could be replenished, Large said. So in times where the all of these very biologically useful elements like phosphorus and some of the other ones we mentioned are getting sucked back down into the mantle at subduction areas faster than they're getting released from the mountains and other deep mineral sources, these are bad times for life on Earth. Suddenly it's like life is not getting its vitamins. Boyle's article also mentions several other interesting theories. I'm not going to go deep into detail about. One is that plate tectonics could be responsible for atmospheric oxygen on Earth. There's basically a two-step procedure here. First of all, plate tectonics create continents with rocks that don't react with oxygen in the atmosphere as easily as the iron-rich early rocks of Earth did. And then after that, carbon dioxide gets released from rocks into the air and the ocean that feeds the growth of photosynthetic organisms like algae, which in turn produce oxygen as a waste product, sort of an oxygen two-step. Which, of course, at the time was very bad for Earth because oxygen is a poison and it will kill you, but we evolved in the wake of that poison atmosphere and here we are breathing it. And then another interesting idea that her article mentions is the work of Robert Stern, who is a geologist at the University of Texas, Dallas, who posits that because of plate tectonics, we have more opportunities for evolution on Earth than you might expect otherwise, because the rearranging of continents and seas through plate tectonics drives selection effects and the evolution of new species. Stern says, quote, you need isolation and competition for evolution to really get going. If there is no real change in the land-sea area, there is no competitive drive in speciation. That's the plate tectonics pump. Once you get life, you can really make it evolve fast by breaking up continents and continental shelves and moving them to different latitudes and recombining them, which I don't know if I'd ever thought about it quite like that before, but you do kind of see this effect throughout history as continents drift around, they smash into each other. together. They separate from each other. You see different life forms kind of going their own way.
Yeah, coming into contact with each other for the first time, just changing the scenarios that are driving evolution. That's fascinating. I never really thought about it that way. But if you could look at a planet with plate tectonics as being like the ideal laboratory for evolution to take place in, it's kind of like it has an automatic shuffle mode in place.
Yeah, I like that. Plate tectonics puts biology on shuffle. That's so good.
Otherwise, you're just going to listen to that one track over and over again, or you're just going to listen to the first three. You know, you need to have it shuffled up every now and then, so you'll experience the album in a new order, and suddenly you're going to find new favorite tracks.
All right, I want to talk about one last thing before we finish up here, which is an article I was reading about the use of volcanoes and plate tectonics as a proxy for habitability when searching for exoplanets.
Because that makes sense based on everything we've said here. If, you know, in the same way that we would look for signs of water on another world as a potential sign that conditions could be right for life, then perhaps looking for volcanoes makes sense as well.
Yeah, so I was reading about this in a NASA press release that was covering a paper published in Astrobiology in 2015 by Amit Misra et al. Called Transient Sulfate Aerosols is a Signature of Exoplanet Volcanism. I think these researchers were out of the University of Washington, and they're publishing a method for detecting volcanic activity on exoplanets to figure out which ones might be good candidates to host life for all the reasons we've been talking about. Now, this began with students trying to find ways to detect plate tectonics on exoplanets. Obviously, you can't resolve the surface of an exoplanet with a telescope or look at it long enough to know if it's got continents that are moving around. But the lead author, Amit Misra, said in this press release, quote, "I came up with the idea of looking at explosive volcanic eruptions as a proxy or stand-in for plate tectonics. I'd done some work modeling aerosols produced by volcanic eruptions for other projects, so I started looking into how we might detect an eruption and what it would tell us." Now, this is specifically focusing on explosive volcanic eruptions that tend to happen at the edges of tectonic plates. Again, I mentioned this earlier, but if you look at a map of tectonic plates, you'll notice that the boundaries match up to lines of volcanoes on the surface of the Earth. Now, what is it about explosive eruptions in particular? We've all seen footage of volcanic eruptions that are not particularly explosive. They're basically kind of gentle lava flows, relatively gentle. You know, it's still a planet. And even during more, you know, middle-of-the-road volcanic eruptions, the gases and aerosols that get expelled from the Earth often tend to fall back to the surface pretty fast, at least fast on a geological scale. But during these really highly explosive eruptions, gases and particles shot up from the volcano are often shot into the stratosphere, where they can linger for months or years, and they affect what's called the transit transmission spectra of the planet. This is something that we can actually detect with telescopes at a distance of, you know, as far away as other stars and their planets are. So by looking at the frequency of light reflected by an exoplanet as it transits in front of its star, between us and its star, you might be able to detect whether there are transient sulfate aerosols from explosive eruptions in the stratosphere, which in turn would be a good indicator, though not a guarantee, of plate tectonics down on the surface. The authors of the study write, quote, "We propose that the detection of this transient signal would strongly suggest an exoplanet volcanic eruption if potential false positives, such as dust storms or bolide impacts, can be ruled out. Furthermore, because scenarios exist in which O2 can form abiotically in the absence of volcanic activity, detection of transient aerosols that can be linked with volcanism, along with detection of O2, would be a more robust biosignature than O2 alone," right? So this is linking to another idea people have had, that if you can look at an exoplanet and detect oxygen, free oxygen in its atmosphere, that might be a sign of life in the atmosphere, because, you know, oxygen is often a byproduct of organisms like photosynthetic organisms on Earth. But, you know, O2 can be produced by other things. So they're saying if you find that and you find signs of volcanoes, this is a good sign that this is a living planet.
I mean, it sounds like a solid argument to me based on what we've seen here. And it's and the thing is, I mean, it's still vital information about the nature of a given world. So it's not like you'd be, you know, chasing after a wild hare here. This would be essential information either way.
Exactly. Now, on the other hand, we mentioned that volcanoes are not a sure sign of plate tectonics. And this brings me back to something I wanted to talk about that was also from Craig O'Neill, because O'Neill was writing about how, you know, because of the assumed association between plate tectonics and life, some astronomers and astrobiologists are interested in looking for exoplanets with the potential for aliens. And they've tried to focus on places where plate tectonics seemed likely to exist. And one candidate that O'Neill points out was long thought to be these planets called super Earths. They're terrestrial or rocky planets like Earth, like Mars, like Venus, but even bigger than Earth. And O'Neill writes that it was once believed that the odds of finding plate tectonics on big planets like this was higher. But now it seems like that might not actually be true, because computer simulations have shown that you can probably have very large rocky planets without plate tectonics, and instead with a surface conforming to this thing I mentioned earlier called the stagnant lid model, which sounds gross. Basically, it's where the interior of the planet is hot, it's cooling, it's releasing its heat, and the heat is released through volcanic eruptions, but the surface does not have moving plates. And so no recycling of water and CO2 to the interior like we have in the subduction on Earth, no formation of mountains or natural mineral sequestration like we have on Earth. It's just going to be kind of a big rocky planet with a hot interior that has volcanoes, but the volcanoes just sort of poke up occasionally out of its solid spherical rocky shell. And O'Neill and the co-authors of his paper that this article was based on were addressing the question of how is it exactly that planets evolve over time? And they came to the idea that planets might start hot and turbulent, and then far down the road they end up cool and geologically inactive, and that, quote, "We found that the evolutionary track a planet takes depends not only on its size, but on how it starts. For example, two planets identical in every other way, but with different starting temperatures, may evolve down very different evolutionary paths." And so what they argue is that plate tectonics, like we have on Earth, might simply be a phase in the evolution of planets, sort of a lacuna between two eras of stagnant lids. And it's possible Earth was once a stagnant lid planet with a single hard shell, and now we have plate tectonics, and maybe one day we will not have plate tectonics anymore.
So if this is the model that habitable worlds take, you would end up having, assuming they live long enough, some sort of highly evolved life form ruling over a stagnant lid Earth.
That's possible. Though there was another report I was reading that complicates all this, because, you know, as I was saying, this is still not a fully settled question. I was reading a report from Penn State News about a couple of Penn State researchers, geoscientists there, named Bradford Foley and Andrew Smy, who argued that no, in fact, their findings showed that you don't necessarily have to have plate tectonics to sustain life on a planet. Given certain conditions, you can just have volcanoes basically keeping the planet roughly the right kind of temperature. Now, that wouldn't invalidate all the stuff we've said about the role that plate tectonics have played in the evolution of life on Earth, but it's still basically just an unsettled question, it seems to me, whether or not plate tectonics are really necessary for the existence of life on a planet or not. By the way, one cool thing I came across, I didn't get super deep into this, but it's also hypotheses about what happened to Earth's early stagnant lid in order to turn Earth into a planet with subducting plates moving around, sliding under each other. And one theory is that it was asteroid bombardment. So Earth may...
That'll mix it up.
Yeah, exactly. Earth may once have had this solid shell on the outside where without moving plates, and then some kind of impact or series of impacts broke it all up and got things churning around. And ever since then, we've had a crust in the form of moving plates instead of one solid plate.
And that has a very kind of divine feel to it, right?
Right.
Like a stagnant world that is no longer advancing or creating anything new. And so now some force beyond them has to rain down destruction so that new possibilities can emerge out of this shattered, stagnant lid.
Yeah, and the one last thing I want to mention here is that O'Neill points to one of my favorite objects in the solar system as an example of an object like a planet that can be geologically active and have volcanoes without having plate tectonics. And that example, of course, is Jupiter's moon Io, the yellow hell of Galilean sulfur. You know, this was one of my favorites when we did the episode about Jupiter's moons. And so Io is Jupiter's innermost major moon. It's very geologically active, even more so than Earth. It's the most volcanic object in the solar system. And this is a result of tidal forces that act on the guts of Io. It's a gravitational manhandling by Jupiter sloshes the guts of this moon around, and its heat mostly escapes to the surface through what O'Neill calls heat pipes. These are volcanoes, not through the movement of tectonic plates.
So to come back to our god analogy here, in this case, the god that is Jupiter is too involved in the nature of the planet. It's like a micromanaging oppressor, as opposed to one that just periodically brings about destruction.
Yeah, exactly. Jupiter, it will never leave you alone. And I think what Io needs to do is to go down into the void and get the Demogorgon to come up and kill Jupiter like he does in what's that play? Prometheus Unbound.
Huh, there you go.
But anyway, so I don't know. I found this really interesting. I don't think I had ever looked this deeply into how entangled the geology of Earth, and specifically its mineral geology, its rocks, are with the evolution of life on Earth. I think I'd always thought primarily about like temperature and liquid water.
Yeah, or I'd probably focus more on sort of everyday human level things, like the fact that the soil near a volcano is going to be rich and good for growing things, or that volcanic activity creates land that can eventually be become habitable, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But this is a much deeper dive into the truly geologic level of the whole equation.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I think that does it for now, but I hope you've enjoyed this journey into the volcano.
Absolutely. And of course, as before, when we discussed volcanoes on the show, we want to hear from you about your experience with volcanoes, life near volcanoes, visiting volcanoes, active and dormant. How does this affect your interpretation of these amazing sights? And if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, well, you can find us wherever you find your podcasts. And wherever that happens to be, just make sure you rate, review, and subscribe if you can. These are acts that really help the show out in the long run.
Before we wrap up, I've just got to say, so I don't forget, we need to get some Mountains Are the Toilets of the Atmosphere t-shirts made.
Oh, I don't know if that would be a bestseller. I don't know. Why not?
Worst t-shirt ever. Okay. Anyway, huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, just to say hi or to suggest a topic for the future, whatever you want, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.